We arrive here today to debate at social distances from each other.
There's no doubt that the old politics of the two-party system is now gone and over.
I don't need lectures from you or anybody on the Sinn Féin side of the house.
We're very reluctant to say what's red lines, but we do have to take climate seriously.
There's going to be constant criticism, there's going to be a lot of disappointment, and whoever goes into government is going to be unpopular.
Okay. Hello, and you're very welcome to RTÉ News' Your Politics. I'm Paul Cunningham, taking you through for the next 20 minutes of insight into what's really happening at Leinster House. Joining me today, our political correspondent, Micheál Lehane, and also Sandra Hurley of our political staff. We've just all been watching the Justice Minister, Helen McEntee. She's been speaking to the Dáil, both giving a statement and also answering questions regarding the judicial appointment process surrounding Seamus Wolfe's appointment to the Supreme Court. Sandra, it was quite a long affair. There was about 2 hours, and there were some things we knew and some things maybe we didn't know. Let's just take the first one, which I thought was rather stark. And it was that Ms. McEntee said that there was no specific criteria when it came to judicial selection, or that instead she used her own judgment in coming to a determination about who might be the best candidate. Very stark.
Yes, completely. I mean, she stuck to what we've heard all along, which is that she made the decision on her own. The actual final decision, she didn't consult with anybody else. And what she wouldn't reveal, and she was pushed many times on this, are what are the criteria? How did she evaluate the applications? Because what we learned today, we always knew that Seamus Wolfe's name had come through JAB. There were other expressions of interest. We learned today that was 5 expressions of interest from sitting judges. There's also another list of judges who are eligible for promotion, as it were, to higher courts. And we didn't learn anything about how a minister makes that decision. And it is an enormous decision. And I think it exposed so much about, or rather, how little we know about judicial appointments and how these are made.
And that very fact that there wasn't like boxes one has to tick, do you look at this, that or the other. She did make a reference at one point that the Judicial Appointments Board had a set of criteria. But once again, when it came to her, it was her alone who was making this decision. Now, she did say that this was a process which she wanted to reform. She was seeking opposition assistance in doing that. But nonetheless, when it came to selection, it was just basically up to her.
Yes, completely. She said, you know, it's always been this way. The Minister for Justice brings that one name to Cabinet. But Brendan Howland made the point. He said that in all his time in coalition governments, and that's a lot of experience there, he said there was always discussion amongst the party leaders about the names and all the individuals involved, and that they would have certainly discussed those. But the situation here is that the Fianna Fáil leader, Micheál Martin, and Eamon Ryan were told that Seamus Wolfe's name had come through JAB. They were told that at the same time that they were apparently agreed collectively that there would be a new Attorney General. That was the end of the government formation process. But I suppose the key thing we learned here today was that Leo Varadkar said to Helen McEntee in her early days in her new ministry that Seamus Wolfe, he said, would make a good judge.
Micheál, take you in on that, because that, to my mind, was probably the sentence that stood out over the two-hour debate, and it was something that the minister mentioned on several occasions. It wasn't like a slip in any way. This was a matter of fact which she wanted to bring before the Dáil.
Yeah, that's the big revelation, isn't it? The thing we didn't know. And it's interesting that the person who knows a lot about what's going on in relation to this is Leo Varadkar. He tells Eamon Ryan and Micheál Martin, as Sandra said, around the time the government is about to be formed, that there is a vacancy there and that the outgoing Attorney General has applied through JAB for that particular role. And then when Leo Varadkar speaks to the new Justice Minister, he also expresses that view in clear terms, that he believes that Seamus Wolfe would make a good judge. And he's also said along the way that he believes Seamus Wolfe was always approachable and a very competent Attorney General. So the one person, along with the Justice Minister, who knows a lot about what's happening throughout all this is the Taoiseach and Fine Gael leader.
It was mentioned, I think, during the 2 hours that we also learned that there were 5 judges who'd expressed an interest, but we didn't learn how many judges on the third list would be eligible for promotion.
Yeah, I mean, it's that notion that there are 3 lists and that somehow one minister can weigh it all up. She doesn't speak to officials and doesn't have any other conversations bar that brief one with the Tánaiste, and that's before she has seen the other names anyway. And he says he never knew the other names. So that's all Helen McEntee had to make the big decision on, that brief conversation, and whatever other political experience she's gained along the way. It's a remarkable way to appoint a Supreme Court judge.
Helen McEntee said that this is the process, and once again, we all want to reform, and I'm going to seek your assistance in bringing it there. But when it came to the choices and decisions that she made in determining that judicial appointment, was there any hostage left to fortune? And the only point I thought where there was a sharp difference related to Labour's Brendan Howlin and her, where he was talking about, was there any list or extra information given to the leaders to allow them know that there were other candidates involved? And he seemed to be suggesting that this was the practice in the past. And she was coming back saying, no, it's always been the case. Only one went forward. And she said she consulted with her officials on that, because he was asking, did you go back and look at the documentation related to the last time a Supreme Court judgment came through? Did you see if there was anything else? And she said, I asked my officials and was told no.
Yeah, she asked her officials, would the names, the context of that question seemed to be, would the names be in the appendices of the memo going to Cabinet? And as she understood it, no, that would never happen. So everything followed the normal procedure as she understood it. And that, I mean, that's the way, I mean, you couldn't say there are any breaches when you look at this, but equally you can see the political charge, and it is a fairly clear one being made by the opposition consistently, that what has happened here is that someone from the government ranks up until a few weeks previously gets elevated to the Supreme Court, and no one really knows how Helen McEntee arrived at that decision, because she doesn't speak about, because there was no criteria and there was no way that you can determine absolutely how she weighed up the merits of those other judges. There's just no way of determining it, but that leaves the political charges and makes them all the more potent, I suppose.
From your point of view, Sandra, we had an awful lot of comment being made by opposition parties regarding the question of belief. Opposition TD saying they just simply didn't believe that the minister on her own, without any reference to anyone else, arrived at this position. And as Micheál is indicating, there's no objective criteria there, so it was solely up to her to take that decision as the process currently stands. Taking a step back and just looking at it all, does it sort of maybe confirm what a former minister who's just recently brought out a book suggests, that the way in which we're operating at the moment just simply isn't good enough?
Completely. And Shane Ross obviously making that point. He tried very hard to get to change the process. People weren't happy, I think, in particular with the fact that he wanted a lay chair of this Judicial Appointments Commission. The government making a big push now of saying that they committed to that in the programme for government and they're going to push it forward. Helen McEntee got that into her speech today as well. But it certainly needs reform. And I think we heard it very clearly from the opposition here today. Sinn Féin's Martin Kenny said, you know, this was a done deal. A Fine Gael Attorney General was on the way out. Fine Gael had to find a job for him. Fianna Fáil went along with it and the Greens didn't know where to look. And he said it was all boxed off before you came in. And that really is the absolute essence of this entire controversy about the appointment.
So the other question is, I mean, was there any appetite at all among Fianna Fáil and the Greens, among Eamon Ryan and Micheál Martin, to look at this a little bit more deeply? And there doesn't seem to have been.
But let's put sort of the Fianna Fáil side on this. Micheál Martin, you saw him getting exercised clearly earlier on in the week, saying, I specifically did not want to get embroiled in this process. And once I heard that it had gone through the Judicial Appointments Board, well, then that was a process which seemed to be working effectively. And the best thing I could do was stand back and let it go.
Yeah, that was very much it. And that is the central thing. He says the presidents of courts were on that, and then it was chaired by the Chief Justice. And that was good enough. That was good enough for him.
Which reflects something that Leo Varadkar said. It was also good enough for him as well. So that seems to be some cohesion within the coalition leadership about the process and its acceptability.
Yeah, it was good enough for everyone, except that question remains as to how the merits and how the applications or expressions of interest from the other judges were weighted. And it just seems extraordinary. And I mean, in some ways, you can take all the political charges and then you can just look at the process and you could say, well, this is a strange way that this has been done and this is allowed to be done for a long time now. And equally, a lot of people talking about Shane Ross now, and I know Fine Gael were committed and backed Shane Ross. But I mean, at the same time, there was a lot of senior Fine Gael figures walking around, throwing their eyes to heaven at the notion of what Shane Ross was at there. And I mean, when that government was formed, what was the thing that caused the most difficulty in cobbling that alliance with the Independent Alliance at the time? It was that whole question of judicial appointments. I couldn't say that you could say absolutely across the board in Fine Gael and that government from 2016 to this year that there was an absolute commitment to change this process. But on paper, and yes, Charlie, yes, the ministers and all the ministers went down and they did back Shane Ross and did their bit. But was there fire in the belly to do it? I'm not so sure.
Just one other point on the expressions of interest that I thought was interesting. The five expressions of interest that came in apparently from 2017 up until this year from sitting judges, they went to the Attorney General's office, and the question was asked by the opposition, well, Seamus Wolfe was the Attorney General, did he see those? Now, Helen McEntee said that she didn't know if they actually crossed his desk personally or if they went to officials, but they were passed then on to the minister. But it does seem to be a very odd process.
Particularly yeah, very, when so many Attorney Generals are appointed to Superior yeah. Courts. Sorry, Michael.
Yeah, 30 was it more than 31 in the history of the state, Padraig Tobin said.
Yeah.
But also, Helen McEntee, really unclear about that the expressions of interest go to the Attorney General's office. But there was this question mark, do they somehow, without being seen there, make their way up to Stephen's Green to the department?
To her department.
To her department, directly.
Yeah. Mm.
They never reviewed. Somehow some strange pigeon is brought over and he flies up to Stephen's Green.
It's strange. Sandra Hurley, if I can just ask you another question relating to the political hellfire and brimstone. I mean, this was a concerted campaign, a unified campaign by the opposition to ensure that Helen McEntee went into the Dáil, made a statement and went through a questions and answers process. They were so unhappy that the question and answer process wasn't long enough. It went to a Dáil vote, which they lost, and so they went in and did it. What happens now from the opposition's perspective? Does this effectively run out of rope? There's a process, it's flawed, we can't know what happens because of separation of judicial powers, therefore it's just going to run into the sand.
Yeah, I think one of the key things that's going to happen in terms of the news cycle anyway is we're all going to be, we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, but this Christmas, the lifting of restrictions and all that, that is just going to take over from tonight and tomorrow onwards. So that's going to eclipse it, I think, a little bit. Also, perhaps the key point that she has maintained the whole way along is that she adhered to the process. And in as much as we know about the process, and it seems to be fairly secretive, she seems to have adhered to it. The key thing we learned today is about the view expressed by Leo Varadkar, but as to how far that can go, I'm not sure. I think this really, she came in, she answered the questions. As you say, they weren't as long as the opposition wanted them to be, but I think hopefully from her point of view, this will put this to bed, and I think that may be the end of it now.
I think the override group, though, probably is in the spotlight now, and that will be there probably next Tuesday, next Wednesday, when the Dáil comes back again. He's going to face questions about that.
Or maybe next Thursday when he comes in to answer leaders' questions. That might be the next opportunity. So it's still got a chance to
run. Just a figure from Padraig Tobin and former AGs at 16 out of 31 have got promoted to court roles.
Right. Let's park that there. Sandra very handily mentioned the question of COVID-19, the question of level 5 restrictions, and we have got this strange subcommittee on COVID-19, which is going to adjudicate and make a recommendation to the full cabinet tomorrow about what needs to happen. Tell us more, what is this committee and what exactly are they going to do?
Well, that's the committee with the party leaders, with the two ministers responsible for finance, and also the health minister, and they're going to speak to NPHET this evening. NPHET already expressing concern, particularly and unexpectedly, about the hospitality sector that's reopening the restaurants and the gastro pubs. They're urging caution there and have some real, real concerns. That wasn't a huge surprise to government, but does it make the deliberations this evening a little bit more complicated? It does. I suppose they have their own research, this time fairly stacked high, compiled by independent consultants, the CSO and other government departments, and they'll also look at things about around like capacity in the hospitals. That will be a key measure as well. As it stands right now, when it comes to easing those restrictions and in particular opening the hospitality sector, is there enough in NPHET's warning to change the kind of plan that's at a fairly advanced stage at this point? It doesn't seem so. But yet, you think those discussions will be fairly extensive, as will the cabinet tomorrow. So you couldn't say absolutely, but they seem to be ploughing ahead as they go into that meeting, that view that the economy does need to be reopened in the lead up to Christmas to try and generate some activity.
And we have seen this before, Sandra, when the chief medical officer returned and there was a hoo-ha over its recommendation that the cabinet subcommittee invited in a delegation from NPHET, including the CMO, and I think also Paul Reid from the HSE, in which they kicked around things, made a presentation, argued their point, then they left. And then the subcommittee decided what it was going to do, with others probably like the Secretary General of the Department of the Taoiseach, Martin Fraser, in there as well.
Yeah, and that seems to have been very much the way the big decisions have been taken over the last couple of months. And I think that's really interesting because there is a centralisation there of the power within government and the decision making, because it seems to be the case that the cabinet subcommittee drafts the memo that's then put to cabinet. And from what we hear, it's not changed all that much at that wider cabinet meeting. So those decisions seem to be taken within a more select group of the ministers, including the three party leaders, and then they're passed it on for something that looks like a bit of a rubber stamping.
A rubber stamping, or I mean, I suppose when we always hear about that the cabinet can vote, but it rarely does. It's usually by consensus. So on that basis, it's possible for, say, a minister of state who's been given an elevated position to go in to cabinet on Friday lunchtime and kick up a stink and say, I'm holding out for whatever they want to hold out for.
Yeah, it is. I think
shake down some sort of extra little piece.
That probably will become particularly relevant if there is a degree of ultra caution tonight and that memo becomes something that perhaps other ministers weren't expecting, and it does roll back a lot on opening the hospitality sector. Then I think you probably would have quite a difficult cabinet meeting tomorrow if that were to be the case. I don't think it will be, but there's uncertainty. I mean, there are some within the government who are floating the idea of, could you perhaps look at restaurants? And restaurants back in the summer is something that NPHET thought were just restaurants alone and not gastropubs. Could you decouple them from the gastropubs and leave them closed? Now, already that notion, as it was presented yesterday, the view among publicans is that there would unquestionably and almost immediately be acts of civil disobedience, they're calling it. They would open those premises next week along with the restaurants. So perhaps it wouldn't even be enforceable.
I mean, this is the thing, it's fraught. I mean, if you're going to say, for example, a public house can't reopen unless it has a chef and a kitchen, how do you decide what a kitchen is? How do you decide what a chef is? I could be a chef.
Yeah, and so many bars we know have been getting, you know, organising a delivery from the takeaway place next door, and that constitutes the €9 meal, or there's a pizza van in the back garden. So why can't they open? But yes, we've heard this thing about the kitchen, and how are they going to measure the kitchen? What constitutes the kitchen? It's getting very detailed.
One other thing, and just to get sort of a little bit niggly, we do have something called cabinet confidentiality. We're not supposed to know what happens inside those dark rooms. We'll remember the banking inquiry when they sought minutes of that famous deal, the multi-billion euro deal, and it was legal advice came through, you can't find out. So what exactly do we know about what is going to happen inside that cabinet on Friday, and will we know who was leaning one way and who was leaning another?
Well, I suppose like the key ministers are already there, aren't they? They are in place at the special cabinet subcommittee, and then if you look to the wider group, you look at people like the education minister, that's not as relevant anymore on this particular easing of restrictions. And then you look to the former health minister, who's now the minister for higher education, who's always taken a view that public health advice is key, Simon Harris. So, I mean, you can see it from there, the different fault lines. I suppose from what he has said on his way into cabinet in recent days, Michael McGrath is the one in public expenditure who seems to be pushing for the maximum amount of opening up the economy, feeling that that needs to happen.
We're not just going to talk about domestic politics. We also want to talk about European politics, because we're on the cusp of possibly maybe a breakthrough on Brexit, which obviously sometimes gets lost amid the storm. Sandra Hurley's just stepped out. Aisling has just stepped in. You were reporting on what was happening in European politics. The Commission President was also talking about that hot topic of Brexit. What did you have to say, Aisling Kenny?
Well, I'll just start just where we are at the moment, Paul. Just, I suppose we know that the deadline of the 31st of December is fast approaching, and pressure has really been mounting on both sides to reach a deal. Now, as we know, the talks process has been beset by difficulties from the very beginning. This week has been no different, when a member of Michel Barnier's staff contracted COVID-19. So these negotiations have been kind of ongoing remotely this week. Now, Michel Barnier is due to come out of quarantine today and was due to travel to London for talks tomorrow. Now, this actually hangs in the balance today because he has said he won't travel to London if the UK doesn't concede on some of the outstanding issues. We all know what they are at this stage: fishing in UK waters, the level playing field and governance. So that really hangs, you know, the talks process and the negotiations are really hanging in the balance today. So it remains to be seen what happens over the weekend. In relation to Ursula von der Leyen, you mentioned there, she had mentioned Brexit in the European Parliament this week. Now, she really didn't mince her words, Paul. She was taking kind of a tough stance as well, saying that she didn't know whether a deal could be reached or not. But she was saying, you know, the integrity of the European Union cannot be compromised. She said the EU is willing to be creative, but she said, you know, that they are prepared for a no-deal Brexit.
It's interesting. I heard our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman, speaking on the radio this morning when he was trying to draw all the things together. And he felt that if you look at the UK's position with COVID and with Brexit, that it would be nearly impossible for them politically not to sign up to something just to get them through for a number of months. While those tough lines are there, to a certain extent, one wonders, is that just a negotiating, strategy? Both the head of the Brexit group and also the Commission President themselves, just trying to push the UK one last bit.
Yeah, I think it is a tough stance, a particularly tough stance that the EU are taking this week. The UK, interestingly, today hasn't really come out to respond to the EU, saying that they wouldn't, you know, continue negotiations unless they were willing to compromise on these outstanding issues. So we're still really waiting for reaction from the UK. So that's where we are at the moment.
Waiting for Godot, Holohan, has been a long time since 2016. Does look, I feel, that something's about to happen. What's your sense of it?
Well, I think that is the sense around here. And you look at that legislation to prepare for all eventualities that's going through the House at the moment. There doesn't appear to be that kind of urgency that would be in the air if no deal was in sight. It's certainly not evident here at the moment. But of course, that's the opposite where we were at this point last year, where it looked as if things were crashing and suddenly at the last minute it changed. So one cannot be sure.
If there was going to be a real sense that we were heading to a no-deal Brexit, would it be the case that you have this place crawling with whether it's lobbyists or every single organisation under the sun because they would feel that it was a reality and therefore the legislation going through was more important? Is that it?
Yes, and I think you probably wouldn't have the Minister for Foreign Affairs in the chamber this morning saying that and confirming, which is good news for younger listeners, that Santa Claus does have permission under all COVID-19 rules to come in and out of the country, and that has been sorted by government. And that is something Simon Coveney said in the chamber this morning.
One thing actually, Paul, very
interestingly.
You're
not going to be able to Trump Santa now.
Well, this might not Trump Santa, but just an interesting point that was made in the European Parliament this week was that, you know, a major voting session would be held on the 28th of December if a deal is reached between both sides. The Parliament has to ratify that deal. Now, that just shows how close, I suppose, any deal will be to that deadline of the 31st of December. So the pressure is really on.
The pressure is on. We've been saying that for a while, but it really just, we have a sense that it's heading to crunch time. Listen,
before we go, just some early soundings coming from the Convention Centre in the aftermath of that debate.
Yeah.
A view within some, within government, that really didn't go well at all because of the fact that Leo Varadkar is now centre stage in the whole thing, and as well that it raises serious questions for the Greens and Fianna Fáil that they're going to be brought back into this to ask about what they knew and if the object was to put a full stop under it. Far from that has been achieved.
But isn't it the point that the Green Party and Fianna Fáil was saying, once we knew the jab happened, then we didn't want to know anything else? So why would they be pulled back into the debate?
Because I suppose the Taoiseach was more centrally involved than they may have known up until this afternoon.
That's Micheál Lehane, our political correspondent. Ashin Kenny from our political staff, and also Sandra Hurley was with us earlier on. Thanks very much for listening to RTE News' Your Politics podcast. We are flying by the seat of our pants today, just immediately out after the Justice Minister's two-hour debate. Thanks very much for joining us. Please do subscribe, and if you have any comments, please do leave them. We love to hear from you. But thanks for now. Thanks very much.